when I come and I do different events in Nebraska Corn Board, I get two questions right off the bat. First of all, how does a kid from small town Nebraska get on the bobsled team? And what in the world does he do representing corn growers or corn farmers? So, and obviously this morning already I got those questions here while we were sitting at lunch. But I grew up in Shelby, Nebraska, which is about an hour and a half drive from here. I always tell people it's on L Street, 84 miles west. Population of Shelby is 690 people, pretty small. 25 kids in my graduating class. I like to tell people, or my teammates especially, the other three guys in the bobsled team, that you know, there's not a stoplight in my hometown. And that's not uncommon. You know, a lot of small towns in the Midwest don't have a stoplight. There's not a stoplight in my entire home county. Whole county. So it makes it even more unique than those other small towns as well. While I was growing up, and I usually tell elementary kids this, and it blows them away. While I was growing up, my mom wouldn't let me have a Nintendo. And those kids look at me like, how did you survive? Now, this was before Xbox, before PlayStation, but my mom wouldn't let me have a Nintendo. It would drive her crazy if I would sit around all day just watching television. So there's no way she was going to get a video game system that would encourage, you know, that kind of mindless activity. She encouraged me to be doing something active all the time. Being outside, you know, playing games, getting dirty, you know, staying out of trouble, but, you know, just doing something all the time, whether it's reading a book, you know, for fun, sounds crazy, playing a musical instrument, whatever it was, you know, be active in something. And I didn't know it at the time, but that's what got me onto the bobsled team 8-10 years later. When I went, growing up in Shelby, Nebraska, of course, you know, I played all kinds of sports, small town, you know, Midwest, you know, you don't have a whole lot of kids in the high school, so everybody has to play every sport in order to you know, fill a full team. So I played football, I played basketball, I ran track in the springtime, I played Legion baseball in the summertime, but football is my favorite sport. And if you play football in central Nebraska, someday you want to play for the Big Red. That was my big goal growing up. I wasn't offered a scholarship. I wasn't even asked to walk on at Nebraska. I went to Nebraska on an academic scholarship to study electrical engineering. Now, that sounds like a lot of fun, right? But I went to Nebraska on an academic scholarship. While I was there, I got this desire to be active, you know, in something more. So I went to the coach's office one day during the fall of my freshman year, and I said, is there any way I can still make the football team? And they said, yeah, you can try out just like any other student that goes to the University of Nebraska. So in January of my freshman year, I tried out for the team with 119 other kids. They kept three of us. I was pretty fortunate to make the team in that way. And they asked me to join the team as a running back. Now, this is back when Nebraska used to run the football all the time. You know, we were going to run the ball 80% of the time. We were going to run it right at you, and it was up to you to stop us. And I was going to be a running back on that team, I thought. Big difference in what they were asking of me and what I thought that they were asking of me. They wanted me to be a scout team running back, not to carry the ball and score all the touchdowns, get all the girls type of running back. No. A little different. I was running the opponent's offense throughout the week of practice so that the starting defense could get a good look at what they're going to be facing that upcoming weekend. And I was getting my butt kicked every day. You know, but I was picking myself up off the ground, play after play, day after day, and I stuck with it. So the coaches, they promoted me, call it a promotion, they promoted me to defense because, you know, if I was going to get some more playing time, I had to switch positions pretty much. Because of my career offensive stats, ready for this? One carry for 2 yards. Thanks. But I moved to defense and I worked my way up the special teams depth chart. And then after my junior year, senior year, I was on the starting kickoff team, the starting punt team. And, you know, I got a little bit more playing time now. But I wasn't on scholarship yet. I wasn't getting a whole lot of playing time. I wasn't getting much respect for what I was doing. But I stuck with it, and man, I loved it. But when I was done playing football there, again, I knew I wasn't going to the NFL. That was pretty clear. You know, some college football players go to the NFL. Some college football players become electrical engineers. I thought I was going that way. But while I was going to graduate school, I met a girl. This is, of course, the answer to the first question, how did I get onto the bobsled team? Starts with a girl. I met a girl that was recruited to be on the women's bobsled team. She ran track at the University of Nebraska. She was big, strong, fast, and powerful. And she was a little bit shy, so she didn't want to go through this tryout process by herself. So she talked me into flying up to Calgary, Canada with her to try out for the U.S. bobsled team. Now, just like most of you, I'm from, you know, the plains of Central America here, or the Central U.S. There's not any hills here. You know, my idea of sledding while I was growing up, and I always hesitate telling youth this story because it's probably not the safest thing in the world. But sledding to me when I was growing up is we would tie a saucer sled with a 40-foot rope to the back of a four-wheeler. and drive around out in the pasture. That was what I called sledding. I'd never seen a bobsled in real life. And, you know, I'd seen Cool Runnings, of course. Everybody knows the story about the Jamaican bobsled team. But that was all I knew about bobsledding. But I went on a whim, kind of went on, you know, an adventure, I guess. And that was 8 years ago. And I'm still on the current U.S. national bobsled team. So it turned out pretty well for me. Now, in 2006, after about a year and a half of being on the bobsled team, I had a problem. Now, I was poised and I was in a great position to make the 2006 Olympic team that was going to be held in Italy. But I was broke. You know, to be on the bobsled team, you have to keep amateur athlete status. So I couldn't be paid to be on the bobsled team. But, you know, there's other ways you can make money. You can, you know, find sponsorships, you know, work for endorsements and that sort of thing. But, you know, being a bobsledder from Nebraska, it's pretty hard to find sponsorships. So I told some people from Shelby about my little problem. And they said, don't worry, we'll take care of this. And I didn't know what they meant at the time. But they said, on June 25th, the summer before the 2006 Olympics, we want you to come back to Shelby. We're going to have a little fundraiser for you. 690 people in Shelby raised $25,000 for me to be able to bobsled. And that's incredible. My teammates, the other three guys on the bobsled team, are from Buffalo, New York, San Antonio, Texas, and Salt Lake City, Utah. Cities of at least 500,000 people or more, right? If they have a fundraiser in their hometowns and they raise $5,000, they're pretty excited. I had 690 people raise $25,000 for me. And that only happens in agricultural-based communities, you know, where farmers come together, you know, where they know that there's something special more than just their own cause. You know, and I love telling this story because that's where I grew up. And I grew up in that small town where everybody knew my name, everybody knew my parents, everybody knew my grandparents while they were growing up in that small town. Shelby had a golf tournament, a steak feed, and a street dance to raise this money. So I always think that basically they were looking for a reason to party. And I just happen to be that reason. But regardless, that's become my favorite part of my Olympic story. You know, I hope a lot of you are watching the London Olympics as they're going on, you know, right this very minute, actually. When I came up from downstairs, I noticed on the television that marathon swimming was on. You know, so, you know, these athletes that are competing as I'm speaking right now, you know, they're living out that dream. And I hope they have the same kind of story of that support as they grew up as well. But I made the 2006 Olympic team, and we finished in sixth place. We were the USA 2 sled, meaning that we were kind of the junior varsity sled. USA 1 that year finished in seventh place. So it was a pretty good feeling knowing that the younger brother got to beat their older brother. You know, we were, again, that JV team, and it's a pretty good feeling when you can beat your older brother at something. You know, everybody's a little bit competitive, and they know what that feels like. After the 2006 Olympics, I was promoted to the USA 1 sled. And in the past 4 years, in the 4 years between 2006 and 2010, we have a World Cup season every year. We have about 10 races that take place from October through March. And, you know, we have to compete on this World Cup circuit in order to qualify for the next Olympics. And in those 4 years, the United States had more success as a bobsled federation than they had in the previous 60 years combined. We'd won a number of World Cup races, World Championships, which is our Super Bowl at the end of the non-Olympic years. And then, of course, the 2010 Olympics went pretty well for us, too. So this time going into the 2010 Olympics, you know, I wasn't quite as nervous about being selected to the Olympic team. I was pretty confident in my spot, which was now on the USA 1 sled. And I missed out on something a little bit. You know, I got caught up in my spot. Wasn't quite as nervous about making it or not making it. You know, and this time, you know, I had a couple more sponsorships. You know, after you make the Olympics once, you can, you know, learn to find ways, you know, have fundraisers and that sort of thing. So I was worried about winning a medal. That's what was drilled to me. You have to win this medal. This is what your job is. You know, we've had a lot of success. So going into 2010, I missed something. I'll come back to that here in a second. But I got to go through the opening ceremonies in 2010, just as I did in 2006. And I have to tell you, how many of you saw the London opening ceremonies about 10 days ago? Quite a few of you. I have to tell you that the opening ceremonies for an athlete is the single greatest honor any athlete can experience. You know, it's better than a Super Bowl. It's better than the World Series. You know, you're representing your country to the entire world. And that's something pretty special. In 2010, I was the top-rated brakeman in the country, actually. So I got to do both two-man and four-man as the brakeman for the USA 1 sled. I had the same driver, Steve Holcomb, for both two-man and four-man. Our race is 2 days. two heats on a Friday, two heats on a Saturday. They had the total time for the four heats, and that's how they determined the winner. After the first day of competing in the two-man race, we were in fourth place. We were 13 hundredths of a second away from a bronze medal. And, you know, 13 hundredths of a second doesn't sound like very much time, right? That's, you know, less than a blink of an eye. So my driver and I, we thought, you know, we have to do something just a little bit better in order to win that bronze medal. Well, if you compete in sports and in a lot of things in life, you'll realize that there's such thing as trying too hard. You know, sometimes you can try too hard and you forget what comes naturally to you. And that's kind of what happened to us in that two-man race. I thought I was going to push the sled two steps farther down the hill. And without getting too technical, those last two steps that I thought I was going to, you know, pick up a little bit more speed, instead of being able to drive the sled backwards, instead of being able to push backwards, we're going so fast downhill I had to step out in front of me, just a little bit, and that cost us a couple hundredths of a second. My driver thought he was going to take a couple shortcuts, call them, I guess, down the track, and it wasn't the natural fast line that gravity would take you down the track, and that turned out to backfire a little bit, and that cost us a couple hundredths of a second. So we went from fourth place to sixth place. You know, we were a little bit disappointed. But at the same time, you know, that fueled our fire even more to do well in that four-man race, which was going to be held the next weekend. In the four-man race, we were considered a medal favorite. We'd had a lot of success going into those Olympics. We won the world championship the year before. So there was a lot of pressure on us, but we put that pressure on ourselves because we knew we could do well. As Kim introduced me, you know, the United States hasn't won an Olympic gold medal in bobsled in 62 years, since 1948, going into that. So the media wanted to put a lot of pressure on us, but we kind of were able to ignore that, and we put that pressure on ourselves. At halftime, call it halftime, after the first day of competing in the four-man race, instead of being behind the medals by 13 hundredths of a second, we were leading the race by 36 hundredths of a second. And I know that doesn't sound like very much time, a third of a second. But in bobsled terms, that's a butt kick. And we had a pretty good lead at halftime. Call it 30-0 at halftime of a football game. You know, so it's, you know, so we had a pretty good lead going into that second day and a lot of confidence. But if you remember watching the 2010 Olympics, especially the sliding sports, luge, skeleton, and bobsled, you might remember them talking about curve 50-50 of this bobsled track. Now, curve 50-50 was curve number 13 of the 16 curves. Curve 13 got its nickname, Curve 50-50, because when they were first testing the track, sending down professional bobsled pilots, 50% of them crashed in Curve 13. And it became the focus of a lot of attention, negative attention. There was a luge athlete that was actually killed practicing for the lugers coming into that. He lost control in Curve 50-50, was ejected out of the track, hit a steel pole, was killed instantly. So a lot of people were nervous about this race. So even though we had this huge lead, and as we're going down the track, and I'm the brakeman, I'm the guy in the back of the sled, I've got my head buried, you know, I'm looking at my ankles, and that's about it. But I can feel the curves, you know, I can feel the pressures, and I know where we are the whole time because I have the map kind of memorized in my head. So as we're going down curve 10, curve 11, curve 12, and I know that curve 50-50 is coming up, because if we happen to crash in curve 50-50, which happens quite often, if we happen to crash there, that big lead that we had was gone. We got through curve 50-50, and there's about 8 seconds between curve 13 and the finish line. And I don't think my heart beat for those 8 seconds. You know, couldn't wait to finally cross the finish line. And as we're going up the finish line, up the braking stretch after the finish line, being the brakeman, it's my job to pull the brakes. It's a pretty simple task. I just pull up on a lever, teeth come out of the bottom of the sled, and drag us to a stop. Like I said, it's not a hard task. It has a glorified name, but it's not that big a deal. But I have to judge where to stop the sled, of course. And, you know, as I'm pulling the brakes, I'm trying to see the scoreboard. I'm trying to look at the clock, you know, find something that had told us we were in first place. We were the last sled down the hill. So if we cross the line in first place, there's nobody left to beat us. But I can't see the scoreboard because there's some idiot almost falling into the track with his finger up in the air. It was our head coach. And as I'm going up the braking stretch and I pop my head up to pull those brakes, that's the first image, the first snapshot that I have in my brain of us winning Olympic gold medal. That was the first thing that I saw. And I'm never going to forget that instant, that moment. Since then, life has been a little crazy. You know, there's a lot of things that come with winning a gold medal that I wouldn't have guessed, you know, as I tried out for the U.S. bobsled team 8 years prior to that. I play a little bass guitar, so I got to play on stage with Pearl Jam a couple years ago. And I hope this crowd appreciates that a little bit more than the elementary kids. I'm a big Cubs fan. I got to throw an opening pitch at Wrigley Field. I got to ride an F-16 fighter jet. I threw up 3 times. I like to brag about these stories, and that is, I'm bragging about those 3 stories right now because those are pretty awesome things that I got to do. But the best thing I get to do is I get to go around to different audiences, and I get to talk about bobsledding, and I get to share a little message that I learned along the way. I told you about growing up in Shelby and how that support that I had from them got me to the Olympics. That's not a lie. Without 690 people in Shelby, I wouldn't have been able to get to the Olympics. You know, and you think, well, you multiply that by 10 or 100, you know, 100 times, that many more people will just help you get to the Olympics even faster. No, I think there's a maximum amount. You know, 690 people was the right size for me to grow up in that size of a town in order to get to the Olympics. That agricultural-based community got me to the Olympics. You know, I learned those lessons from those farmers, those corn farmers that work hard every day, knowing that there's good days, there's bad days, there's good years, and there's bad years as well. You know, you don't always come out on top. You don't always win. You don't always get one of these that you can put in your pocket. I don't always keep it in my pocket. But at the same time, you know, I understand from those farmers that, you know, there's good times and bad times. You don't always get recognition for doing hard work, for competing with honor, pride, and integrity. You know, I mentioned before the 2010 Olympics, before the opening ceremonies, I was caught up in my position. I was told, you need to win an Olympic medal. The coaches told us that. The media told us that. The United States Olympic Committee said, this is what your job is. In 2010, we had the chance to qualify 3 sleds at the Olympics. Now, the United States, we almost always get 2 sleds, but we have the chance to qualify 3 sleds if that 3rd sled is ranked in the top 20, and there's only 2 countries in the world that can qualify 3 sleds at an Olympic Games. Again, I was on USA 1, I was focused on that. So just before the last World Cup race of the season, the last race that would help determine who was ranked in the top 20, the driver of the USA 3 sled came up to me and said, I need your help. I'm ranked 21st in the world right now. I need to finish 13th or better in this last race, and I have to beat the Russian team and the Swiss team by 2 or 3 places in order to qualify for the Olympics. He said, I want you to push me in the 2-man race. This is it. You don't have to push me at the Olympics, just this one race. My team will push in the 4-man race, but I just want your help in the 2-man race. And of course, the obvious answer is for me to say, yeah, sure, I'd love to push you. We'll, you know, go win the race and live happily ever after. It's not quite that simple. The other 3 guys on my team, I went to them and I told them the story, and I knew what their concerns were going to be. We had a 4-man race that was going to be held the next day, and we had to finish 1st, 2nd, or 3rd in that 4-man race in order to clinch the overall number one ranking in the world. If we're number one going into the Olympics, we get to be the 1st sled off the hill. So we get the smoothest ice, the freshest ice. And that's a big advantage of bobsled. So my teammates were concerned that if I was just a little bit tired from the race the day before, you know, it wasn't going to help us win. You know, hundreds of seconds count in the sport of bobsled. So my teammates said no. So I went to my coaches and I explained the situation. And I have to explain that our coaches are paid from the United States Olympic Committee. The USOC gets their money from sponsors. You know, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Hilton, all that sort of thing. Most of the time, those sponsors are worried about winning medals. They don't necessarily care that we sent 216 athletes to Vancouver instead of 212. You know, they weren't concerned about sending that 3rd sled. So my coaches said, no, you really don't need to do this. So I went to bed that night and I thought about it for a while, and I went to Mike, the driver of the USA 3 sled, and I said, yes, I'll do it. Okay. So he kind of looked at me and he said, why? And I told him this story about when I went to an elementary school and I spoke to a class of probably 13 kindergartners. And I was telling this story, you know, about bobsled, and I was explaining how fast we go, and I showed them pictures and all this, you know, trying to get them excited about the sport. And then at the end, I always ask, you know, are there any questions? And that's always very interesting, asking kindergartners if there's any questions. So after I answered, you know, what's your favorite color and how many pets do you have? There was a kindergartner that asked me probably the most intelligent question I've ever heard. And I don't think he meant it to be that intelligent, but you know, during my talk, I showed him my Nebraska football jersey because they were all Nebraska fans, and I showed him my USA speed suit, the spandex suit that we wear, you know. And he asked me afterwards, he said, why does your Nebraska football jersey say Tomasevich on the back, my last name? And your USA speed suit says USA on the back. And I got to think about that, and I, of course, I don't know what answer I gave, you know, the kindergartner, but I got to thinking about that. You know, when I played football at Nebraska, I got to represent myself. I represented my family, you know, while I played football there. But when I push for the United States, I'm not representing just myself. I get to represent the entire country. Good or bad times, whatever it is, I get to wear that red, white, and blue for my job. That's something pretty special. So I'm going to push every chance I get. And when I push, I'm going to give it 100% every time I can. Now, I don't tell this story trying to brag, but when I pushed Mike the next day, we finished in 13th place, and we beat the Russian team and the Swiss team by just enough to qualify Mike for the games. Now, that's a happy ending, of course, but as we were going up the braking stretch, and again, I'm pulling the brakes, there's three guys that were the first ones to congratulate us as we came up off the braking stretch. And that was with the other three guys on the USA 1 sled. Same guys that told me no 2 days before that, you know, but they were there cheering louder and harder than anybody else. So it was something pretty special in order for me to experience that. Because when we walked into the opening ceremonies about a month later, we weren't USA 1, USA 2, and USA 3. We were Team USA. That was something pretty special. So, again, just one of the lessons I learned, again, because I grew up in this kind of environment, you know, where the agriculture community is so important. And I have a lot that I have to give back to that community. And that's why I like to represent the Nebraska Corn Board. That's why I like to represent the agriculture community and farmers, not just in Nebraska, of course, but the entire Midwest, the entire United States of America. That's something pretty special for me, is to be able to stand up here today and talk to you. You know, I know it's you have a tough task in front of you. You know, whether you're playing the political game, you know, trying to wager wars in Washington, D.C., and that sort of thing, trying to convince people of the importance of ethanol. And it's a great thing. You know, decrease our dependence on foreign oil. You know, I'm speaking, don't want to talk to the choir too much about this, I know, but at the same time, you know, you have a tough task in front of you. There's going to be good years, there's going to be bad years. You're not always going to get something you can put in your pocket. You know, a lot of times you have to, you know, compete for just the honor, pride, integrity of doing the right thing. You know, that's just as important as winning a gold medal, whether you get something you can put in your pocket or not. So, with that, thank you very much for paying attention. Take a little break out of your desserts, I guess, but I appreciate the time. Thank you very much. I also have appreciate that. I have a video here I'm going to show, just in case, you know, a lot of you might not know exactly what bobsledding is, but I'll end with this video.